Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business episode 371. I'm Patrick Gray. In this week's feature interview, we chat with Richard Baitlick. He currently serves as the Chief Security Strategist at FireEye, but he's also a non-resident fellow with the Brookings Institute, and he joins me this week to talk about the OPM breach, honeypots, China, and Edward Snowden. All sorts of stuff in that interview. That's a fun chat, and it's coming up after the news. This week's show is sponsored by Palo Alto Networks, and this week's sponsor interview is with Ryan Olson of Palo's Threat Intelligence Unit 42. Yes, that is a Hitchhiker's Guide reference. I love them for that. Ryan will be joining us to discuss an APT campaign they've uncovered in Asia. They call it Lotus Blossom, and it's yet another example of what is likely state-sponsored APT activity targeting the region. And depressingly, this campaign makes pretty good use of CVEs that start with the number 2012. That's great news, huh? So Ryan joins us later to discuss that. But before we get into all of that, it is time for a check of the week's security news with our good friend, Adam Boileau. And Adam, last week we spoke of Samsung screwing the pooch when it came to that, that keyboard flaw on 600 million Android devices. Well, this week, let's just say Samsung has married that pooch. They've converted to Mormonism. They've married another pooch for more sweet, sweet pooch love. There's a lot of pooch screwing going on at Samsung.
Woof, woof, yes. So they, on their Windows box, you buy a Windows box from Samsung, it ships with a piece of software called Samsung Software Update, which keeps your Samsung software, you know, all of the nasty vendor bloatware that you don't need or want, that comes with the Samsung box, it keeps it all up to date.
So far, so good. This sounds great. Like, I mean,
it is important to update software. That is, you know, number one on the, you know, ASD's top 35 mitigations for stopping cybering. Unfortunately, one of the things that they do whilst they're updating your software is disable Windows Update. So you can have all of your Samsung tools updated, but none of your Windows is updated.
Pooch orgy, yeah. Man. There's paws everywhere. There's paws and tails and snouts. Oh, man. So much pooch love. So what the hell? Yeah. I mean, really, I mean, you just, what the hell? What the cock, yeah,
well,
as you would say.
Well, exactly, yes. What the cocking cock is something I think it's up to. And someone asked, actually, there's a researcher who you know, found this, pulled it apart, actually asked Samsung why particularly they decided to turn off Windows Update as part of their update service. And it's because there are, for example, and I quote here, for example, if there is USB 3.0 on laptop, the port may not work with installation of update. So to prevent this, SW update tool will prevent the Windows updates. End quote. Which I'm not sure is actually Samsung PR per se. That's the support chat help desk you get on like the website if you go to Samsung.com.
Yeah.
So maybe not a regular official PR spokesperson, but yes, there you go.
Yeah, I mean, this is legit too. Like, I'm seeing it. I mean, it started off as a blog post, but it really looks like they disable Windows Update.
Yep, they apparently they do.
Well, my mind is blown. So, look, I mean, we've been saying this for probably not long enough, but I think it was after, what was the one that we reported on, the something fish one?
Oh, the Lenovo.
That one. You know, since then, like, really, when you're buying a laptop, any type of laptop, just blow away all the vendor's crap on it and just roll a fresh install. I mean, you'd think that is the go-to advice, right?
That is the go-to advice. Although the silver lining in this particular case with Samsung is, at least compared to last week, I imagine there's probably less than 600 million Samsung-branded Windows boxes out there. So, you know, that's a thing.
Yeah, not quite that many, which, yeah. Thank heavens for small mercies, all of that. Now, of course, the OPM breach is still the biggest story going around. And, you know, the numbers started off like with 4 million records maybe breached. And now, depending on who you listen to, it's either 32 million, it's 14 million. It's, you know, we just have no idea. But, yeah, maybe as many as 32 million current and former employees' personally identifiable information has been leaked due to the Chinese hack of the OPM database.
Yeah, and it's getting plenty of mainstream media coverage. There's been kind of comparisons of it as being more important to U.S. national security than Snowden, and it's good to see a breach like this being taken relatively seriously. But as you say, the numbers are just all over the place, and I mean the numbers that we're talking about here. I mean that 32 million number, for example, came from actually a budget request from the OPM saying that because we look after as many as 32 million people's records, we should probably have some more money for securities, please. So that by that extension, if they didn't secure them,
it seems reasonable. Right.
Yeah, but interestingly, like these are numbers are kind of first order, right? These are the people who have security background checks or whatever done through the OPM. What it doesn't really cover is all of the other people who are kind of secondary actors in this. Like, so when you get a security clearance and they interview everybody you've ever lived with or whatever, right? All of those people have some data in this data set as well. So I mean, the even if we're talking 14 million or 4 million or whatever, there's still quite a lot of collateral damage. I mean, even something as simple as this data set, you got to be able to bypass everybody's password reset question. Right? I mean, all of the ones about your mother's maiden and whatever, because all the mothers are in there. So it's just bad on so many fronts.
Yeah, well, the Wall Street Journal's carrying a really interesting editorial, which is unfortunately behind a paywall, but it says that, it really says, hey, people said the Edward Snowden thing was damaging, but this is much, much worse. And they sort of step through some pretty, reasonable thinking here, which shows just how bad it is. For example, if you've got employment records for the State Department, you've got the identities of 30 people who work in an embassy, and there's only State Department records for 27 of them. Hey, I wonder who those other three work for. stuff like that. I mean, you've got lists of people's children, their neighbors, their friends. Do you know what I mean? That's very powerful stuff. I mean, maybe not so much for blackmail, but I don't know, give us access to this network or do this act for us, or how about I kill your kids? That kind of works.
Yeah, well, exactly right. And we've seen, personal relationships via social engineering, used as vectors for intrusion. The classic Google Aurora, right? That started across a, instant message chat, according to the stories that we've seen, based on a personal relationship. Just being able to map that stuff out, right, is super valuable when you're doing recon. And of course, the irony of this data being used in the security clearance process to identify opportunities for blackmail, so you know who's at risk of blackmail if you give them a clearance. The irony of having that exact data being stolen so that the adversary, presumably China, now actually has a list of who they should blackmail and what about, right? I mean, it's f***ed.
Are we going to call it a digital Pearl Harbor yet?
I see.
Maybe this is it. Would we even know if there had been a digital Pearl Harbor?
Well, exactly. That's a very good question, Patrick.
look, moving on to the cool, cool, cool tech story. Let's talk Pitter.
Let's talk Pitter. Yes, indeed. So a group from Tel Aviv University that had been working on a bunch of wireless hacking related stuff over the years are demoing a device that will do data leaking out of EMF radiation from a CPU in a machine. So VanEck, Tempest style stuff for CPU emanations,
as I like to call it, mind reading for computers.
And they've got a research project which they put together using fairly common off the shelf open source bits and pieces that they are using to sniff some aspects of crypto operations on the target CPU through having it encrypt or decrypt target decrypt data that they control to kind of make the processing more suitable for what they're trying to sniff. They're sampling this with a relatively low frequency device, so they're getting like small windows of data and then using that to reconstruct some information about the key material. But the main aspect of this, which is of course getting some traction, is the fact that it's called the Portable Instrument for Trace Acquisition, or PITA, it is indeed small enough to fit inside a pita bread, which is quite a nice hook.
Although probably not the tastiest filling I can think of.
No, it's not. Falafel probably better than...
falafel, a little bit of lamb shawarma, bit of hummus.
But no, they're certainly, in the style of naming our vulnerabilities, stupid things like ghost or whatever, at least this is tasty.
How effective is this though? Because this is the sort of thing on the surface reading of it. If you imagine it's like a magic wand that you wave near a computer to suck keys off it. Is it practical or is it just on its way?
I imagine, I'm sure it's practical often in Spookland. I mean, they've been doing Tempest and this kind of thing You know, forever, I guess.
Now, yeah, but I mean, that's been more about picking, you know, signals off monitor cables or out of monitors themselves. I mean, this is actually grabbing EMF off a CPU, right? This is kind of hardcore.
We have seen people do, I mean, you know, monitors are just the obvious one because they had, big tubes in them back in the day, you know, doing it off other things, LCD monitors or whatever, is a little more complicated. But I mean, anything that, that consume power in this way, you have some options for pulling that. We've seen people do it off keyboard controllers across the power lines. There was it may have even been the same group actually that demoed that a few, must be 5 or 6, 7 years ago now. So there's all sorts of options for doing this kind of, you know, VANEC freaking. So I mean, doing it off a CPU is interesting because the CPUs are so high frequency and their sampling is so low frequency relative to the CPU. And that's quite interesting, like using statistical techniques to be able to extract out of this, despite the fact that the, you know, CPU is going at gigahertz and they're sampling at, you know, tens or hundreds of kilohertz. So that's really interesting. And if you can, you know, generalize that technique to, you can imagine you get to a point where you can use the Bluetooth radio in a laptop that you've owned that's near an air gaps classified system and then, you know, pull data out. Like, that's the end game, I guess. And you would imagine that Spookville has already, you know, gone down that path a fair way.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're pretty much over the hills over there in terms of how far along they are. But
I mean, the fact that, yeah, you can find them in the hell. There was a case for one of their Tempest certified workstations, like in the Army surplus shop down the road from me a couple of years back. So yeah, I mean, obviously they're well across this kind of thing. Mm. But yeah, seeing this reproduced in the open research is really interesting stuff.
Hey, WikiLeaks is back in the news for all sorts of reasons. Of course, there were the Saudi document dumps, which were, I think, what was that, last week, the week before. You know, they released an absolute ton of material relating to Saudi diplomatic movements. Now they've been releasing some material saying that the NSA has been owning the French and, you know, they've just catapulted back into relevance again.
They really have, actually. Yeah, it's been a really, you know, busy month for them. Across the Saudi stuff and the Trans-Pacific Partnership stuff they've been working on. Mm. But yeah, this French stuff, I imagine, is having a bit of a, you know, certainly stirring the pot a bit in Paris at the moment. And they've got, you know, high-level intelligence summaries of data that's been of intercepted conversations and things. They've got, you know, phone numbers of French presidents going back, you know, 3 or 4 administrations and all sorts of other, you know, bits and pieces that they're leaking, you know. So it's, you know, WikiLeaks back in the top secret department. One of the documents, quite ironically, is an intercept report about a conversation between Sarkozy and some of his advisors about what they're going to complain to the US about over them being intercepted. So they've intercepted the complaints about the interception, which
that's,
you know,
very meta.
It's certainly a sign of the times.
So Kim Zetter over at Wired has done a really good roundup on the current state of play with the Wassenaar arrangement. This is, of course, the arms control bill that looks increasingly likely to be applied to, you know, software technology, you know, intrusion technology. How they've defined it is still really as clear as mud. It's a good little roundup, you know, but every time I'm seeing another data point emerge, I think there was a Daily Dave posting by Dave Itell where he spoke, you know, he was on one of the calls with the Bureau of was it industry and security or whatever they're called, BIS. You know, no one's hearing anything very reassuring out of BIS when it comes to this stuff, and it just looks like we're hurtling towards, I think the comments closed July 20. They want to do the right thing by the sounds of things, but it still just looks like they're gonna f*** it up.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the essential motivation seems good, but everything they're doing along the way, you know, it just makes you want to smack your head against the desk if you actually work in this industry and understand the realities of, you know, how the tech works and the malleability of that tech and the, you know, speed at which this knowledge can be transmitted or moved around. I mean, although, they, you know, they're saying that this doesn't specifically cover exploits per se, but it covers, you know, kind of tool chains for assembling exploits into blah, blah, blah. Yeah, not that it's clear at all. Either way, you can't read this article or the one we that fact.
Well,
we
you can't read anything and actually know how it affects you. Right?
No, exactly right. The only thing you get out of reading Kim Zetter's article is I would like to smack my head on the table now.
Yeah.
And you know, no one who is involved in the decision making process, I think, really understands what it is that they are, you know, attempting to, you know, write rules about.
Well, and you'd think, okay, well, they're worried about arms control. They're worried about people selling, you know, tools of oppression to, you know, dodgy states and whatnot. You'd expect them to enforce it accordingly, but this is a country that's using the Sarbanes-Oxley Act to prosecute terrorism suspects for clearing their browser history.
I know, and I want what the...
Oh, now look, The Intercept this week carried, you know, really what I think is a bit of a beat-up, saying, oh my God, the Five Eyes intelligence agency's targeted antivirus software. It seems they've got their hands on some warrants. I don't know if that was a Snowden document. I think it was, but warrants that... were issued by British courts allowing GCHQ to reverse engineer antivirus software in order to pick it apart, you know, find bugs in it, things like this. Apparently they needed the warrants to kind of creatively get around copyright concerns due to, you know, legal concerns around reverse eng. But I mean, how is this at all news? I mean, it's not like they've written a thing saying they targeted antivirus companies, but really, when you look at it, what they're saying is they targeted antivirus software. You know, they were reverse engineering it to figure out ways to evade it, maybe ways to own it. But that's not targeting the AV companies. That's targeting their software.
There's a couple of documents that the Intercept published, and one of them was this warrant application for GCHQ to, you know, basically be exempted from copyright and license agreement restrictions on against reverse engineering. And most of that does seem like bread and butter kind of things you'd expect them to be doing. And the fact they even bothered to go and ask nicely to violate the license agreement is, you know, more respect than most people who reverse engineering would do. But there are some other documents, like, and one of them relates to a collection program by the NSA SIGINTing emails and other data submissions into and out of AV companies to gather samples that are being submitted by the software. So that's a bit more of a target attack on AV companies. And they one of the examples they give of this kind of analysis they can do there is, you know, Kaspersky antivirus submitting samples that are, you know, trigger the heuristics but are unseen, are previously not recognized by signatures to Kaspersky, and then checking to see A, if it's one of theirs, you know, B, whether that malware can then be repurposed by them because it's not currently detected, or C, spotting things that Kaspersky choose not to add detection for, thus suggesting that, you know, old mate Eugene's up to something sneaky. And there's no evidence that that is the case in these slides, I do add. But yeah, that's a, you know, it is an interesting sort of...
Well, they were also
going in and out of AV companies.
They were also recording things like unique IDs in like the user agent strings for something like Kaspersky. Kaspersky have tried to PR their way out of it, saying, oh, you can't tie a user agent string to an individual customer. It's all anonymized. But if it's a unique ID, it's a unique ID. You start cross-referencing that with other selectors. That's useful, right?
Yeah, yeah, and certainly if you're operating on the scale of the, you know, the Five Eyes, then you have a lot of options for correlating things. Like, you really, you don't need a whole bunch there. So yeah, and that is a little bit weaselly, but no, it's an interesting, you know, it is an interesting set of data. But I, yeah, it's I don't know that it's huge, I suppose. Although I do know on the Wired article about this, I got an ad for Bitdefender, who have clearly bought keyword advertising around antivirus articles. So that's nice.
Now, one person I suspect did not actually get permission to perform some reverse engineering on the old ESET AV is Tavis Ormandy, who may have done a bit of a write-up that's a little bit mean to the old ESET people.
Yep, old mate Tavis looks like he, you know, got in his Hummer and did a bit of a drive-by on the ESET office the last few days. He published some research he's been doing, which is code execution in the x86 emulation engine inside ESET antivirus. Now, a lot of modern antivirus, you know, run code for a limited amount of time in some kind of emulator to try and determine if they're going to do something malicious and to be able to defeat packers and things that, you know, make signature matching complicated, or if they want to do heuristics, that kind of thing. So Tavis, and this is not the first of bug like this that he's found in an antivirus emulator, I don't think. I'm pretty sure he hit a couple of the other ones a while ago now. But anyway, he's got a bug that lets him basically overflow the stack in the emulator of the x86. that's executing this code, and then using that to kind of rop chain his way out to great victory. He's got it working across OS X, Linux, and Windows implementations of ESET Nod 32 antivirus. And the really great thing about this is, any way you can get executable code in front of the scanning engine, it's going to execute it in its emulator and cause code exec. So, you know, catting a file to dev null is one example he gives of how to trigger it on a Linux box, or, you know, reading an email and having that be scanned by antivirus, or browsing the web. So, you know, really easy to trigger, or, you know, stick it on a USB stick and plug it in to an air gap machine. So a really interesting bug in that respect, and exactly the sort of bug that you would expect GCHQ would have been looking for when they were reverse engineering antivirus products.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, it's a it's a bit of a lull bug, that one, right? I mean, the fail is strong in them.
It is. I mean, it's a pretty serious bug.
Yeah,
and I imagine that they will be.
I don't mean it's like a you know, funny advisory. I mean, it's just like it's so bad that it's funny.
Yes, yeah, it is tragic. It's tragic bad as opposed to
exactly.
You know, funny bad.
Yeah, it's not a comedy bug; it's a tragedy bug. Give it time, as they say. Now, there's been an incident in Poland where a bunch of planes were grounded on Sunday after apparently hackers were submitting erroneous flight plans. Now, what's interesting about this is there was a similar event involving United recently that they put down to like a glitch in the system, but it involved this same thing of these flight plans, erroneous flight plans being loaded into the flight computers on these planes. Now, this thing in Poland, they've said it was an intrusion. Now it's being written up as everything from a deep intrusion all the way through to just a DDoS. What do we know and what don't we know? Is someone out there causing trouble for airlines?
Well, that's a very good question, and I do also note that on Tuesday in New Zealand, we had all planes in New Zealand grounded for 4 hours because the air traffic control system blew up due to some technical issue with the company that operates the network that connects all the radars and does all the flight planning. But yeah, we don't know a whole bunch about this particular one. I mean, some of the reports are that it was just distributed denial of service against LOT Airlines that, you know, as kind of collateral damage, took out the flight planning system. You know, other people are saying, oh, well, it's because, you know, ACARS lets you, upload data to planes without any auth, which, I mean, as I understand from ACARS, you know, is the case. There isn't any protocol layer auth. You would assume there was some kind of upper layer auth. And even if that is the case, then, you know, this is just a way to get data to the pilots, not necessarily to the flight computers. It's not like you can just, you know, reroute the plane like that. But yeah, there's really a whole bunch of misinformation, and it's not clear what the root cause of this was, or the one with United, a couple of months ago, whatever it was.
Well, it was only a couple of weeks ago.
Flight bags.
It was only a couple of weeks ago. And, I just think this is interesting, and this is one to watch, right? Because who knows? Who knows what's going on? But if we keep seeing these stories, we're going to have to assume something's up.
well, yeah. I mean, you know, certainly the having all the planes here grounded was a pretty interesting time. There's lots of, it's very disruptive having the airports back up and, you know, all sorts of people's plans disrupted.
Well, governments and airlines not really known for their transparency on these sorts of incidents. So we're going to keep an eye on it and just watch the headlines and see where else flights get grounded mysteriously. Now Ars Technica is carrying a piece which gives us the opportunity to make fun of the US Navy.
Yes, apparently the US Navy's 100,000 Windows XP boxes are in fact still supported. They've gone up to Microsoft and renewed their extended support contract for Windows XP at the prints. They're actually surprisingly small sum of $9.1 million. I would have thought it would be more than that. For 100,000 XP boxes, you would think Microsoft would gouge them for more than that. I mean, given, like, what else are they going to do, right?
Hey, maybe they're patriotic. This is it's alarming, the name of this agency. It's the US Navy's Space and Naval Warfare Systems Command. Gee, why don't we run our vulnerable boxes there? What a good idea. There's a story doing the rounds on LinkedIn's approach to the whole question of bug bounties. They are running them, but they're doing invite-only bug bounties. Apparently, they've paid out about $65,000 to, you know, this select invite-only group. It's an interesting thing that we're seeing, isn't it? This trend towards the invite-only bug bounties, I guess, for more risk-averse organizations.
Yeah, I mean, it is certainly a thing that you would expect. I mean, most of the people that I've talked to who've been involved in running bug bounty programs, you know, one of the things they find very difficult and is very expensive is actually the cost of triaging the bug reports you get. And this is one of the things that LinkedIn mentioned as a reason for doing this, is that the, you know, kind of signal to noise ratio of the bug reports that you get out of a select group versus general public is, much more signal and much less, rubbish bugs that, you spend $1,000 worth of employee time to triage for what turns out to be a, you know, $20 HTTP header missing kind of bug. And that's you can see that as being pretty compelling. But I mean, one of the other aspects of bug bounties is if you've got a public program, then someone who stumbles across something has some incentive to tell you about it, even if it is a very small amount of money. It is one of the diversity of options available. And it's interesting to see LinkedIn, going this route.
Well, it's interesting to see them talking about it as well, because I think the market is really trying to understand what these new models really should look like, you know. But I guess we'll get Casey on the show and talk to him about that at some point. Oh, here's a bit of good news. Our pal Alex Stamos, the CSO of Yahoo, has taken the job as Chief Security Officer of Facebook, which is awesome. Big congrats to him.
Yeah, definitely. That's a real big job you picked up there, buddy. And I'm sure, you know, A, you'll have a lot of work, and B, you'll do a good job of it.
Yeah, and I guess we can go back to making lots of fun out of Yahoo now, because you know, I didn't feel right doing that when Alex was there, because he's such a nice guy.
Bit mean. Like, you don't want to kick the guy when he's down. Because yeah. Well, yes.
Anyway, I'm not sure when he's moving over, but we'll time it and then. We can lol again.
And then we can have some Yahoo episodes, yes.
Oh, dude, Adobe has pushed a fix for a 0-day that is being actively exploited out there. So that's one that Flash users will probably want to get onto.
Yes, very much so. That's what, the third or the fourth, like, 0-day bug being exploited in the wild critical patch they put out in the last month or two. Like, it's been really a bad time for them.
Bad year, man. I mean, this is just, I mean, they did get ahead of it for a while, you know, they really
did. They did, yeah.
And not anymore.
No, definitely not. So yes, go forth and actually just turn off your Flash, right? I mean, really, what do you use it for these days?
Yeah, well, Krebs has a piece up at the moment on his blog about going a month without Flash. And he said that there were only two times that he absolutely needed to use it, which is interesting. But
I mean, at the very least, click to run, right? I mean, there's just no reason to have it on by default, running by default. I mean,
yeah.
Have it installed, have it set, click to run, right? And you've reduced your attack service a bunch.
Oh, now look, there are some more details of more Adobe bugs that Google Project Zero have written about. These are patched bugs. They also affect, there's also some Windows bugs in there, but, you know, Project Zero doing what they do.
Yeah, now this is a write-up of a number of the bugs that relate to font rendering. There's some shared code that's used across font parsers in the Windows kernel and out in Newsland and in various apps that's all kind of begot from Adobe's font libraries. There's a bunch of interesting details about exploiting those. If you're into actually doing these exploits, it's a very good write-up on the Project Zero, from one of the Project Zero guys' blogs.
And meanwhile, HP, the Zero Day Initiative, have gone full disk on Microsoft, which is not something we see very often.
Yeah, so this is an ASLR bypass that they came up with and used during the Pwn to Own competition. ZDI has chosen to go full disclosure because Microsoft says it's not sufficiently interesting to warrant patching, and so therefore there's no reason they can't talk about it. The main issue here is this is an ASLR bypass for 32-bit systems, and Microsoft's like, well, you know, 32-bit's all so last century and isn't really important anymore, and everyone should be running 64 Windows, so it's not a problem. If you are writing your Flash exploits and you'd like them to run nicely on 32-bit Windows, then go and have a look at what ZDI have to say.
Magento has some issues also. There have been three vulnerabilities patched in Magento. So if you run a Magento store, you should probably get on top of them.
Yes, you should.
Drupal has fixed a critical involving OpenID. That's not a good headline.
No, it's not. There's a bug, and I didn't actually get the specifics of the bug because federated auth is horrible. But essentially, yeah, there was some bug in certain particular OpenID providers. The examples given were, you know, included LiveJournal and Stack Exchange. So if for some crazy reason you would like your Drupal users to be able to federate it off LiveJournal because you like living in the past, then you may indeed have a problem. But yeah, it's something I guess everyone who runs Drupal should, with federated auth, should look into.
Meanwhile, there's an old school bug in an old school OS. VxWorks is dealing with a TCP sequencing bug.
I mean, not just an old school bug. Like, this is like amongst the oldest school bugs. TCP sequence number prediction, really? What year? VxWorks, Windows VxWorks is inside, you know, pretty much every embedded thing ever that doesn't run embedded Linux these days, or anything real time pretty much still tends to be VxWorks. And like, really, honestly, TCP sequence number prediction, you know, in your SCADA networks, I suppose, if someone's already on them and is in a position to spoof packets into that environment, I guess you probably already lost anyway. But for everybody else running your embedded systems, don't upgrade them because you can't. Go to the pub.
Yeah. Ubuntu has patched a Privacy bug. And finally, Google has fixed a bunch of bugs in Chrome, which will auto-update across all of their users. And Adam, that's actually it for the week's news. Thank you very much for joining us, and we will chat to you again next week.
No problem, Pat. It really wasn't. I was hoping for better news this week, but it wasn't better than last week.
It wasn't so meant to be.
maybe next week there'll be less dog f***ing.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look back over the week's security news. Okay, it is time for this week's feature interview now with Richard Baitlick. He is the author of several books, including Extrusion Detection, Security Monitoring for Internal Intrusions, and The Practice of Network Security Monitoring, among other books, really. He's found himself at FireEye via the Mandiant acquisition, where he now serves as Chief Security Strategist. Now, Richard wrote a couple of blog posts in the initial aftermath of the OPM breach. And in these posts, he said the government's emphasis, the US government's emphasis on vulnerability scanning and monitoring came at a cost to detection efforts. And that was a critical mistake. Now, Ron Gula, the CEO of Tenable Network Security, directed me to these posts and basically said, you know, if you don't do the vulnerability stuff and you focus too much on detection to the detriment of vulnerability scanning and management, then sure, you might catch some bad actors, but your network will be such a mess that the wider internet will basically eat you alive. You know, he proposed a debate with Richard, which unfortunately we couldn't pull together in time. And luckily too, because in the end, when I spoke to Ron, it seems like both these guys actually agree with each other. But I've wound up interviewing them both separately about these ideas. Ron's interview ran in last week's show in the sponsor slot. But this week, Richard Baitlick joined me via Skype for the feature slot to discuss the OPM breach, where he thinks the government went wrong and how it can be improved. We also discussed how the Snowden disclosures impacted diplomatic narratives on cyber espionage and much, much more. I started off by asking him whether he actually thought robbing vulnerability scanning programs to build out detection is in fact a good idea. Not really, is what he says, but here's what he had to say.
It's necessary to be patching your systems. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. You don't want to make life easy for the adversary, but you also have to have a detection and response capability. And I haven't seen enough emphasis from the government on finding the intruders that are already there. You can look back through history and see, for example, in 2006, it's almost a rerun of what's happening now. Big intrusion into a government agency, that was attributed to Chinese intruders. There's a bunch of hearings on Capitol Hill, we're going to do things better. And as a result, they pushed forward with their CDM program. What they should have done, in my opinion, was find who the intruders who are already there, dealt with them, and in parallel, be working on improving defenses. So I hoped with the recent OPM intrusion to influence that debate so that, yes, we need to make sure it's as tough as possible for an intruder to get into your network. But if it wasn't true 10 years ago or 5 years ago that there are already intruders in your network, we should all accept that they're there now, and especially a target as rich as OPM has proven to be.
Well, it's interesting what you say, because if we take a look at the private sector, it seems that if the will is there, it's possible to at least get it mostly right. You know, last week we had Ron Gula on the show, we were talking OPM, and he said, look, you know, quite often, especially in government, the will is there, but the politics of the situation and the procurement cycles just make it that much more difficult. How do you fix that problem? Because it's that systemic issue there, isn't it? The politics and the procurement and the bureaucracy. Do you think that makes things even more difficult for government than it is for private enterprise?
It certainly does, although I've seen similar dynamics in large multinational conglomerates that I've worked for, without naming them. But the difference there is that generally, there is a single line of accountability at the end of the day. And if that line of accountability believes this is what needs to be done, you can get results. In the federal government, ultimately, the single line of accountability is the president. And if the president doesn't say you need to be fired because you weren't doing your job, then you don't really get a change in the bureaucracy. So I definitely agree with the procurement problem. There is a tendency in the government to go for what they call least cost, technically acceptable solutions as opposed to best value. So you may see the government spending, I think I saw the number was north of $80 billion a year in spending. They could be spending billions and billions of dollars on solutions that don't necessarily have that much to do with fixing the problem. And you can say, well, you know, we did our best. And unless the top line of accountability says, no, this isn't good enough, you don't get any change. So there's lots of pressures here, and I'm not calling for anyone to be fired. That's not my call, obviously, and I'm not, you know, I'm not here to do that. But we have seen what happens in the private sector when, for example, a CEO gets fired, as happened in Target. That wasn't, you know, just because of the breach that they had, but I have friends that are working there now, and it's a very, very different climate.
Mm. I wonder though, you know, say you uncapped budgets and said to people, you know, all right, off you go. The technology industry, the security industry still hasn't really got to the point where you can say, okay, give me one of these, one of these, one of these, and then that's done, has it? I mean, it's still securing a network, even rolling detection properly is still a frightfully complicated proposition. Of course, one of the major challenges facing, you know, all IDS vendors, all monitoring vendors, is the issue of false positives. It seems like, you know, everyone that I speak to is drowning in false positives. What are the detection vendors doing about that, and what should they be doing about it?
Sure. So before I get to that, though, I'm not even sure that the answer in a giant breach like OPM is more funding. I've heard that called for now, years of underinvestment and so forth. But in my experience dealing with the government, more so in the DoD space, you don't get reform when budgets are increasing. You get reform when budgets are decreasing because it forces the management to take a hard look at what's working and what's not working. And that's what's missing in this case, is they haven't figured out what's working and what's not. There seems to be a lot of what's not working, but maybe if they were able to focus their attention. And this is where I get into the whole strategy piece. The strategy is based around finding and fixing flaws faster, and that is not working. So that's why I argued in my Brookings piece and a couple other places to change that strategy. But to your question about the detection rates, this is clearly a problem with signature-based approaches. When you rely on a signature as perhaps your primary way of finding something, you know that unless you have a very, very tight signature, you're probably going to catch activity that isn't associated with what you were first looking for. It's one of the reasons why, for example, in the FireEye MVX technology, it's more or less a detonation chamber. So it doesn't quite matter what the initial way that you find that problem. We care more about what it does once it detonates. And then we know, well, there's no reason for this PDF to suddenly cause an outbound TCP connection that's obfuscated and it's pulling down more code and whoa, you know, hold on, that doesn't look right. That's one of the ways that some of these a little bit more advanced security products try to deal with the whole issue of false positives.
You guys were the original sort of big sandbox, what did you call it? Detonation chamber type of offerings out there. But, you know, you do have a false negative issue there as well, which is that, you know, quite often there's the halting problem with that. Increasingly, malware authors are even doing things like, only run on close in the case of Word documents, which is, causing detection issues there. I guess the point that I'm getting at is not just the false positives, which send people on the wild goose chases, but it's the false negatives as well. I'm just wondering, you know, it just seems like the detection technology, and I'm not singling out FireEye for this, like by any means at all. It just seems that it's not offering that much value at the moment because it's missing the stuff that does matter and sending people on wild goose chases, following up signatures that are tripping for no reason.
So this is the reason why I don't recommend what I call the self-defending network, as Cisco termed it years ago. I did a blog post which I called it the self-defeating network, because the idea that they seemed to be pushing was, if you just put enough of our stuff in place, you'll be okay, and your headcount for security could be zero. I believe that more and more of what we consider security should be just IT. I mean, there's no reason why AV, firewall, all the regular stuff isn't just another obstacle that's managed by IT. And then you have your security staff who deal with everything that the solutions can't. So that's where you have people who are looking for ways to get around the defensive mechanisms you have. You have traditional defenders who are out there looking for adversaries who have gotten around it. And then you have pen testers who are trying to get around it. And a combination of what is found by each of those two is how you deal with the more creative intruders.
Mm. I mean, I'm seeing two things at the moment that I think are very positive, and I want to get your thoughts on them. I mean, the first is that companies like FireEye, companies like Palo Alto Networks, companies, you know, all sorts of these larger security vendors, there's a big rush to the endpoint at the moment. Now, this is In my mind, this is like 5 years overdue, okay? Because any attacker worth their salt has been exfiltrating via SSL since the dawn of time. So it really is funny now that there's been the Snowden docs have come out and everyone's encrypting everything. People have gone, okay, we've got zero visibility onto our endpoints. So they're pushing out there. I mean, that's got to help, right? I mean, when are we going to start seeing these things deployed widely?
Yeah, so there's the issue of overcoming the not another agent feeling that everybody has, which I completely sympathize with. But just as you said, balanced against that desire not to have another agent deployed on the system is this sense that we don't have, I mean, there are plenty of workers out there who are never in an office, and their connectivity to the organization is basically through an affiliation. It's not by being on a network. And by virtue of that, they need to have some type of endpoint presence. And the way we approached it from the Mandiant side was we built endpoint technology to facilitate intrusion investigations. So, in 2002, when Kevin Mandy and I were running around looking at individual systems one by one, and we did 100 systems in a day and felt really good, and then we looked out and saw that there were another 49,900 systems left, we realized there had to be a change. And that's why Mandiant built its endpoint technology. And now what you're seeing is that endpoint technology is seen not just as a forensic tool, but as a real-time detection interdiction tool. And there's even some companies who are saying, well, maybe there's a middle ground where you don't have to have an agent. Maybe you can query via WMI or some other mechanism. But, there's pros and cons to all of that. Mm. But at the end of the day, in my opinion, there's always four main ways you find intruders. The first one is somebody else tells you, which happens 2/3 of the time. And unfortunately, that's probably the worst way to find out. The second way is you use the network. That's my whole network security monitoring approach. The third way is you use logs. So whatever it is you've got out there in your environment, you collect the information, you parse it, you apply some threat intelligence to it, whatever it is you do to pull some information out of that. And then the final place is you're on the endpoint. Whatever it is, computer, phone, tablet, if there is support for those sorts of devices. And hopefully a combination of those four will get you where you need to go.
Now, I did mention there were two things, and it is funny because both, what we're talking about here is HIDs, right? Host-based intrusion detection stuff. This was, there were shipped products 15 years ago that did this sort of thing, and it looks like they're just sort of coming back now because there was a big push. Hey, we can do everything in the network. Well, no. So here we are again. The other idea that's coming back in a slightly tweaked form is the idea of honeypots, but instead of deploying them on the exterior of your network, which seemed to be the original thinking behind them, increasingly we're seeing vendors deploy them to the inside of networks. Now, Haroon Mir over at Thinxt has released Canary, which is a great little product, actually. I think it's $5,000. You get two of them. You just plug them into your network. You set them up to look like an FTP server or an SMB share or whatever. If someone tries to log into it or read a document from it, you get a text message. There's another vendor, I think, Trapex, doing something similar. Rapid7 has virtual images as part of its user insight suite that do similar sorts of things. I mean, this is a very powerful indicator that something is amiss, isn't it? Does it surprise you that it's taken this long for viable commercial offerings, honeypot offerings to come out?
Well, in my opinion, the honeypot tends to be the next step for a more advanced organization. If you don't have the basics in place, I don't necessarily recommend adding a honeypot. But if you've already got the basics in place and you're looking for a high fidelity indicator that something might be happening, honeypot's not a bad way to go. And then if you even want to go farther beyond that, there are a few really advanced organizations that I know of who have the ability that when they detect a live attack in progress, something that, it's usually associated with something that they is a zero day or something that they couldn't stop with their regular technical measures, but they notice it, they can then transfer the intruder into a virtual environment for purposes of studying him and seeing what he's doing. So you've got a spectrum there of capabilities, and it is interesting to see. I'm a fan of innovation, whatever form. It's good to have both commercial offerings. And increasingly, I think, to me, the sign that a commercial offering is ready for prime time is when there is some kind of open source alternative. It may not have all the bells and whistles of the commercial offering, but it kind of tells you that people are wrapping their heads around the idea of whatever that commercial offering is, and someone's decided to make an open source version of it.
See, I wonder about that, actually, because you say that this is something that people should consider once they've got all of the basics in place. But I wonder, in terms of pure value, you know, whether or not it's worth spending megabucks on detection when really those controls are difficult to implement properly. Monitoring them is expensive. There's the false positive problem. There's a false negative problem. Whereas, you know, that problem is substantially lesser when you're dealing with something like honeypots peppered throughout your LAN. You know, I guess what I'm wondering is, could you see, if it was done correctly, that it would be a valid alternative approach to current IDS?
Not necessarily, because let's say that you do get a hit on this honeypot. The next question has to be, well, I've seen this guy in the honeypot. What else has he done? And if you, because, you know, what has he done to things I really care about? If you don't have the instrumentation for the things you care about, now you're kind of stuck. You know, one of the things I've recommended for people, and this is a little bit against what somebody like Marcus Random might say, but he used to say, if you don't ever look at the logs, there's no need to collect them. I don't agree with that. And the reason is, it's good to be collecting information even if you never look at it, because if you get breached and you have that information and you're told by a third party, hey, you've been breached, you have a place to point the incident response team.
Well, I mean, one of the first network IDSs was called Network Flight Recorder, right? So,
yes. Oh, yeah. It was really, you know, that was Marcus's awesome product.
Yeah.
So I do think that there is value in collecting this sort of, or instrumenting your enterprise, collecting that information, even if for no other reason that once you get a breach, you can point the IR team at it. You'll cut down the response time. You'll cut down your response bill, and you'll probably have a more effective response because you don't have to wait for fresh intruder activity to see what he's up to.
Now, I want to take us back a couple of years now. You and I met in, when would that have been? That would have been May 2013. You and I were both in South Africa. I've actually recently just returned from the same conference. But we were over there about two and a bit years ago, and you spoke and then I spoke. And the funny thing is, it was just after the APT1 report. And of course, everyone was talking about APT1. You know, you did a very solid, you know, great presentation on all of the China stuff. And it's something that I touched on in my talk. And then, of course, the Snowden leaks came out a month later and completely changed the agenda. It's been forever changed since then. And I just wonder how this has impacted the way people listen to your message. Because really, it seems to me that this disclosure by Edward Snowden has undermined the moral authority of people seeking to criticize China for its cyber espionage.
Yeah, I think there's a couple ways to look at it. One, who's my audience? If you're an audience person who has been breached by one of these Chinese intruders, then nothing has changed because you're directly experiencing it. If you're a general audience person, yes, I would say it's completely changed because it's hard for the general audience to distinguish between the U.S. government's narrative, which is we may hack, but we don't do it to steal information from private companies and then give it to American companies, versus we don't like the fact that the Chinese are attacking private companies and giving that information to their domestic industries. It took me, a minute to explain that? And that's, you know, clearly outside of everyone's attention span. Now, I think this is a case with the OPM breach where some people have been calling for strong measures against the Chinese for attacking OPM. But myself and a few others out there, people who are of, you know, much greater standing than me, like General Hayden, have said, hey, they're a legitimate government target. And I'm in the same camp. I believe if it ends in .gov, don't be surprised if it's a target for foreign intel services. So I don't think we should be yelling at the Chinese saying, hey, you shouldn't have done that when, as General Hayden said, if he had the opportunity back at his NSA days, he wouldn't have hesitated to do it in response.
So, I mean, you're basically saying anything with a .gov is fair game.
I think I'm a former Air Force intel officer. When I was in the Air Force and I saw any activity against any of my military bases, I completely expected it. That was just what people did to each other. If, however, I'm at a university or I'm at a private company, or I'm at an NGO, and I see a military force coming after that target, that to me is a little bit too far.
So that's now, that's out of bounds. But I mean, you know, we see you know, attacks against the defense industrial base in America. I mean, that's government by proxy, kind of, right? Because, you know, you can't tell me the NSA isn't going after Chinese submarine plans being engineered at some government lab somewhere. I mean, that's tit for tat, surely.
Yes, but with one caveat: whatever we find, we don't turn around and give it, say, to a U.S. submarine manufacturer for purposes of making their submarines better.
Really? But, you know, why not? Oh, that seems unusual.
The biggest reason is, now,
I mean, if they were making better submarines than you, I think that equation would change pretty quick, don't you?
Yeah, well, that, I mean, there has been some discussion in the open about maybe we should do that. Typically, though, it's been due to a lawyer-averse society that says, who would you give it to? You know, would you give it to everyone? Would you not? Now, you did sort of indirectly bring up an interesting gray area, and that has come about through the Kaspersky hack. Are they or are they not legitimate targets? You know, they're sort of in the you could put them in the same boat as a defense contractor, or you could put them in the boat that Eugene Kaspersky brought up, which is he sees his company as more of a hospital. And hospitals, as you would expect, aren't supposed to be targeted. So that is kind of an interesting issue that we haven't figured out yet.
What about in government circles and policymaking circles? I mean, it seemed that right up until the very day that the disclosures happened on Snowden's side, there was mounting diplomatic pressure on China. And then the Snowden stuff just completely sucked the air out of that momentum. I mean, do you think it's meaningfully impacted the sort of global dialogue on these issues?
Oh, yeah, absolutely did. Yeah, there's an interesting dynamic here. From the perspective of the Chinese, when they saw the Mandiant activity, the State Department discussions, all the things that there was just prior to that summit in California, they perceived it as the most well-coordinated government-led operation against them in history, when it was not. There was hardly any coordination. I mean, yeah, it was just a set of events that happened to be sequenced without the parties all saying, this is what we're going to do. So, but from the other side, from the U.S. side, looking at the disclosure 2 days before the Sunnyvale conference, it looked like the most well-orchestrated Chinese operation in order to deflect attention from them. Who's to say what's going on there? But yes, it absolutely changed the narrative for the next 2 years at least.
Scrolling through your Twitter feed, and it seems you're a pretty staunch supporter of the NSA. I mean, didn't it piss you off a little bit, some of these activities? Because, you know, you've been railing against, you know, the abuse of, you know, C&E activities on China's behalf. Didn't it piss you off to see the US doing this, you know, similar sorts of things?
I guess there's a couple of things at play here. One is I was part of, in the Air Force, at the Air Intelligence Agency, I was the what was called the cryptologic service element for the NSA. So my part of the Air Force, we had a gray phone that went to NSA. So I am sympathetic with them. Secondly, I know guys who work there, and I know how dedicated they are. I know they could easily leave their jobs, triple or quadruple their salaries working in the private sector, and yet they're working up there, you know, all weekend working on things that, you know, we can't talk about in order to deal with some pretty serious issues. So definitely my sympathies are with them. I also know that they're under very strict control and controls that exceed anything I've seen in any other governments, maybe with the exception of some of the Five Eyes countries. But the amount of rules and regulations and oversight and laws that they have to deal with is, you know, some people think it's actually excessive. So, and finally, at the end of the day, if you don't like what they're doing, they're not inventing this stuff. They're executing missions that are given to them by the president and the Congress and ruled as legal or not by a court. So I would, you know, if you don't like what they're doing, then we should operate through mainly through Congress and pass laws that say what they can and what they can't do.
So what, the NSA never proposed any of these programs? It was Congress saying, hey, you should grab everyone's phone records and put them in a government database?
Well, you know, I don't know. I'm not the guy I'm not a proxy for the NSA. I'm not, there are people who are out there like Chris Inglis and others who have actually worked there and who've had to argue these cases, that's kind of outside of what I'm comfortable arguing for. I do believe,
well, I mean,
though,
this is kind of why I'm asking you about it. And the reason that I keep pressing you on this is because you've been such a vocal opponent of China. And I'm not saying that's wrong. I'm just wondering why you aren't a little bit frustrated with the NSA for sucking the wind out of your sails when you're criticizing China, you know? I mean, it would seem to make it quite difficult. The Chinese can just sort of point at the West and say, well, you're a bunch of hypocrites. Look at what you're doing to us.
Well, so if it came out that the NSA stole data from private companies or even, you know, state-owned companies in China and then gave it to American industry for purposes of building better products, winning deals, or so forth, I would be disappointed, and I would say it as such, because I've heard so many people say that over time, that's not what we do. I've never seen it myself, but if somehow a program came out in that respect, yeah, I would be disappointed, and I would say something about it. But everything that I've seen has been associated with a foreign intel operation. Could you argue that, you know, maybe the way that they went about collecting some of the data wasn't the best, or the way that they presented it wasn't the best? Yeah, you could probably make that argument. The biggest problem for me, though, is that they never anticipated these programs becoming public. And when they did become public, they didn't know how to handle it properly, as opposed to something like maybe one of the State Department's programs going after terrorist financing. From day one, they thought about what would happen if this became public. Let's brief our allies. There was a much more advanced sense of how to handle this and make sure that people were okay with it.
So you think it's probably the result of, you know, the NSA being famously an agency full of introverts, perhaps not thinking about the external perception of what they were doing?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, how long ago was it that we all called it no such agency? This is a group of people that expected to go through their lives not ever talking about anything. And to go from that to suddenly, I mean, just think about it. A few years ago, who was always in the news? It was the CIA.
Mm.
And then suddenly the NSA is out there out front over everything. So this is not an agency that has a set of institutional experiences on how to interact with the public. And yet they need to have this. And this is probably the best part of Snowden, if there is a best part, is you've got to have the American public be comfortable with an agency that is both secretive and powerful. Those are two things that, you know, we or probably anyone in the world doesn't like. So that's a heavy responsibility. You better make sure that you're doing what's necessary to have people's trust.
All right. Well, Richard Baitlick, thank you very much for joining us on the program. It's been a pleasure to chat to you, and I hope we can do it again soon.
Yeah. Thanks, Patrick. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to your listeners.
Richard Baitlick there of FireEye. Big thanks to him. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Ryan Olson, Director of Intelligence for Palo Alto Networks Unit 42. And yes, that is a Douglas Adams reference, and I applaud them for it. You should too. Palo Alto Networks is, of course, the maker of some very, very awesome kit. Their next generation firewalls are super, super sexy. And if you're not familiar with them and the way they work, you really should take a look. They're very easy to admin. They give admins clicky, pointy interfaces that allow for some surprisingly sophisticated content type filtering. You know, and they really were the first firewall for the web age, which is, you know, about time. We had one of them, right? Well, we do. Go check out Palo Alto Networks. You can find them at paloaltonetworks.com. So Ryan joined me to talk about an APT campaign Palo Alto discovered that they've dubbed Lotus Blossom. Here's Ryan.
It started a little bit over 3 years ago, and the key component of the entire campaign is this Trojan called Elise. We actually know that the attackers named it Elise because they left a debug string in the files, and they includes the actual name in one of the directories that it's called Elise. And something that also was interesting in that string was it was in a directory called Lotus. And we found a couple of other pieces of related malware, which were also using the Lotus debug string. There's one called Evora, which is another Lotus vehicle.
Well, I am a big fan of the Lotus Elise, so.
Exactly. So we know that this one is Elise and the other one is Evora, but the primary tool that we saw used in these attacks was Elise. We saw about 57 or so over the course of 3 years, all which were targeting government and military organizations in Southeast Asia. So specifically, the countries we could confirm were targeted, the Philippines, Hong Kong, Vietnam, Taiwan as well. And then we saw one attack against Indonesia. So pretty small, sort of tight grouping of the attacks, at least as sort of the initial foothold Trojan that an organization, a cyber espionage group would use to get into the network. So it was being delivered through spear phishing attacks. And the spear phishing attacks all used a couple different exploits, primarily the an older one called CVE-2012-0158.
Which 2012, is a, yeesh.
2012, yes. Yeah. So you know that the people they were attacking clearly had some unpatched systems in place, although that's surprisingly common, sort of frighteningly common, in fact. In our case, we can't say how many of these networks they actually were able to breach. A lot of the data that we collect comes from our WildFire platform. So when a malicious file passes through one of the Palo Alto firewalls, it can be uploaded to our cloud system for basically detonating that file in a virtual machine and determining whether or not it's malicious.
This is a fun thing for you guys, isn't it, right? Because you've got all of your client sites out there, and you know, I imagine this is something they opt into, which is to share this sort of stuff with you. And you know, you just get to sit in front of a console intercepting badness all day.
Absolutely. So WildFire, we've got about a little over 6,000 customers using it. So that's a massive network of data for collection for us. And the customers, because it's a cloud-based system, the files have to make their way up to us for analysis. So just in the process of collecting all that, we can both use it to sort of build better threat intelligence about the kinds of attacks we're seeing, but we also use it to make WildFire better, because the more files that we can collect, the more behaviors we can identify, the better WildFire works and actually saying this is a malicious file or this is a benign file. Because if you can imagine how much malware we see, you can imagine the numbers of non-malicious files that we pick up through WildFire.
Yeah, I'm sure sometimes you'd like them to turn the hose down a little bit.
Yeah, especially PDFs. Wow, do we see a lot of non-malicious PDFs. You can just sort of guess how many of those pass through email and across the web every day.
So tell me, you know, it looks like they're pretty lazy with their exploits, this crew, but they're still functional. I mean, what can you say about the quality of the actual Trojans?
So the Trojan itself is pretty simple. As far as a backdoor goes, it gives the attacker everything that they would need as far as executing commands on the system, uploading and downloading files. If they want, they can exfiltrate files, but it's really meant to be that initial foothold in the network. And the one of the interesting components of all the attacks we saw were that the Elise dropper, that exploit file, was actually installing the Elise Trojan, which would then open up a decoy. So the decoys are typically used. It's basically a document which looks like the actual document that was supposed to be sent along with the email. So if you got an email that said, you know, these are new orders for your mission, you open the file, it exploits Word or whatever the Office component that it was exploiting was. Word crashes at that point when the actual exploit occurs, and then the Elise Trojan is installed. And the first thing it does is write a new Word document to the system and open it up with Word, a new, clean, legitimate one. And that doc is really that we call it a decoy because it's really just intended to trick the user into thinking that nothing malicious has happened. So those decoys were really sort of critical in our analysis because, well, we got a lot of samples from WildFire. And in those cases, obviously, we know who the target is because they're our customers. A ton of samples that we collected were from other sources. We share samples with other people in the antivirus industry. We share people who are part of our with people who are part of our Cyber Threat Alliance. And because we could get those samples, execute them, and determine what the decoy file was, it gave us a good idea of who the target actually was. Because if we pop up a decoy file that looks like it's targeting the Philippines Navy because it's written all specifically in their language and it has all the logos and everything that would be necessary to trick someone into thinking this document was created by their Navy, we have a good idea that that's who they were actually targeting. So those decoys were critical.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, now to the fun part, you must have had a stab at attribution.
So we think that there's a nation state behind this, but we don't think in this case we have enough evidence to say which nation state that might be. And for us, attribution is we think it's important.
Well, why don't you just do what everyone else does and blame China?
Honestly, I feel like blaming China is too easy. When you have an attack like this, so we're looking at a whole bunch of countries that are all in the South China Sea. We're looking at attacks against their military and against their government. So the type of data that was likely being collected by this group probably wasn't commercial data. We don't think there were criminals behind this. It was probably nation state sponsored. So it would be easy to just jump to that conclusion and say, this is probably China, but we don't have enough to say it. And as a team, we really don't want to come out and say things that we're not confident about. So,
well, and part of that just as likely be any other country in the region with military interests, which is pretty much all of them.
Absolutely. Cyber espionage attacks are, you know, the province of every single country at this point. So it doesn't require a big military. It just requires computers and smart people.
So have you noticed a drop off in activity around this one since you published the report?
So we published it on Tuesday. So far, we haven't really had enough time to see a drop off. These attacks come, you know, at a rate of, in one case, we actually saw 20 attacks over the course of 2 months against one organization. But they're not the kind of thing that we pick up every day. They're much less common than that. So what we're planning to do is take a look here in a couple months and see if a big change has happened and then publish a follow up, most likely in the form of a blog to say, you know, we haven't seen a single Elise attack in 3 months. And that would be very interesting. Or maybe they continued on, or maybe they changed tactics and we can provide new intel for our readers.
Did you have a bit of a crack at their CNC?
We never attempted to breach their command and control systems. That's not something that my team is typically going after. We monitor them. We keep an eye on the traffic that we're seeing from other malware, because part of our goal in sort of drawing the circle around what we call Lotus Blossom is saying what other tools are talking to the same infrastructure so that we can sort of join them all into one group. And so far, we've really just seen Elise being used by this group, at least with this set of command and control servers.
Mm. Now, before we got recording, you were telling me about a trend that you've seen, which is, you know, it's kind of funny because it's one of these old tricks that is back. And that is that increasingly, malware writers are relying on macros again.
Yeah, macros in Office files, which we found really surprising. Going back, basically in November, we went from seeing nearly zero macro documents coming through WildFire to this huge spike in macro docs. And they were all almost installing the DryDex banking Trojan. DryDex is the latest variant of what used to be called Crydex. And it, at some point, it probably stems from Zeus as well. But basically, the macro worked by the user had to download it, most likely because by default, Word and Excel prevent macros from running unless the user actually clicks a button to trust it. That would pop up and they would say, OK, I'll trust this and move on. And I'm completely convinced that the reason for this is we've had this, you know, almost a 10-year gap, basically, between the last time macro malware was a problem and today. And we have this whole generation of younger people using the internet who never experienced all these terrible macro viruses that we were dealing with, you know, late 90s, early 2000s, before Microsoft got control of them. And they just don't know that if they click accept this macro, they're making a really bad choice and they're getting themselves infected.
Yeah, I guess there's a lot of people out there who would be just sort of too young to remember that, right?
Yeah, too young to remember it, too young to sort of feel the pain that we feel when we see those pop-ups and think, oh, I'm definitely not going to click that. Because I know that most people, you know, who went through that, they just are completely averse to clicking anything that would accept macros. Even when they see a legitimate file, an Excel document where it's clear, like old timers will send an email saying, hey, this has macros in it, make sure you turn it on or it won't work. But that's just not something that young people have to do.
We've also seen macros that do things like run on quit, which is kind of cool if you're trying to get past, you know, these VM scanners, like, you know, FireEye is the one that comes to mind. So, you know, it spins up in a VM. Hey, they run the macros. Nothing suspicious happens. They blow away the VM. So they never actually get to see it do anything. Whereas a real user will load it up, maybe quit the software in a couple of weeks, and then it does its funky business.
Yeah, we've seen all sorts of attempts to try to evade a sandbox, evade by running macros on quit is certainly one of them. We also saw at one point files that I think we were seeing in a Word document that was basically, it had a Word exploit in it. The Word exploit took a while to actually run, though. And the reason that it took so long is the document was something like 50,000 pages long. And if you've ever opened a long Word document, you know that it takes a while before that actually the whole page count, you know, gets complete. And that was a way of sort of timing the Word exploit so that it just took a long time before it opened. And you probably evaded sandbox through that. All sorts of strange ways the bad guys try to get around the sandboxes.
Yes, it is the 90s again, but it sort of reminds me of those old tricks. You know, you could send zip files to a BBS that were like, when you unpack them, they were like 2K, but when you unpack them, they were like 10 gig because they were just, you know, like...
The zip bomb.
Yeah, the character A, you know, 10 gig of that zip doesn't come to much. Now, before we go, Ryan, I understand also that you and Rick Howard have started a monthly podcast over there at PAN.
Yeah, you know, 6 months ago, we started talking about, Rick and I are both fans of podcasts, and we started talking about doing one for for Palo Alto users and people who might want to be interested in what we're doing. And both Rick and I, we've got pretty busy schedules, and we knew we couldn't do something weekly. We knew we couldn't do a podcast that really, you know, covered the latest news because we'd just be too slow for it. So instead, what we decided to do was do a short podcast where we, in each one, we're trying to tackle one of the big issues in cybersecurity. So the last one we published, our big topic was talking about attribution. What's the value of attribution? Sort of what's the scale of attribution from, you know, identifying a particular tool that was being used potentially to all the way identifying what, you know, which human was sitting behind the keyboard when they attacked you. And we're combining those sort of big topics along with the way that we see security portrayed in the media. So along with that attribution topic that we were discussing, we actually talked about a book as well, the ReamD book, which was written by Neil Stephenson, and sort of how what role attribution plays in that book and how well the book actually represents technology. And we think it's a really interesting sort of short listen for people who aren't trying to go to a podcast to get news and the latest information, because we recognize that we're not going to be able to do that nearly as well as this podcast or all sorts of others. So instead, we sort of wanted to make it more like a magazine a little bit, where we talk about these individual topics.
A feature podcast, if you will. Where can people find it?
You can find it. Actually, the best way to find it is on iTunes. We call it Don't Panic. We named it after sort of our namesake for the Unit 42 team as well, the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And you can find it on iTunes, or you can find it through Palo Alto's user group, which is called Fuel. So if you search for a Fuel user group, you'll be able to sign up and get to the podcast there as well.
Alrighty, well, Ryan Olson, it's been a pleasure to chat to you. Thank you very much for joining us on the show to have a bit of a chat about what you've been up to lately and what you've been observing lately.
Thank you, Patrick.
That was Ryan Olson of Palo Alto Networks there, rounding out this week's edition of the Risky Business Podcast. Big thanks to Palo Alto Networks for paying my salary this week and costs. Cheers, guys. Big thanks also to the listeners who are supporting the show through our Patreon campaign. I'm going to have a think about something nice that I can do for all of you. I think there's like 125 or something of you out there who are contributing to the show. Really do appreciate that. Kind of stumped on what to do for you all at the moment, but I will get there. I should also say a big thanks to Virtual Office for hosting the risky.biz website. That's Office, OFFIS. They're based in Sydney. Thanks, guys. You know, they've been hosting the show for something like 8 years, so really do appreciate it. But yeah, that is actually it for this week's show. This week's feature track was recorded in 1972. The singer is Charles Whitehead, and the song is called Between the Lines. And I don't think you can actually get this one on iTunes or anywhere, really. So I hope you enjoy it right now. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.
Sing please at nothing you try to do. Someone